In Hebrews chapter 10, verse 1, "For the law, having a shadow of good things to come, and not the very image of the things, can never with those sacrifices which they offered year by year continually make the comers thereunto perfect. For then would they not have ceased to be offered, because that the worshipers once purged should have had no more conscience of sins. But in those sacrifices there is a remembrance again made of sins every year. For it is not possible that the blood of bulls and of goats should take away sins." I appreciate the opportunity to be with you. Appreciate the invitation. I count it a privilege and honor to be able to fill in for Brother Lawrence. You're so well blessed to have him as your pastor here at this church. I enjoy your singing. I like to hear people sing when they sound like they really mean what they're singing. How very important singing is to the meeting. How very difficult it is to try to preach when there's not been some good singing going ahead and helping us to draw in our minds. I believe it was Peter that said, "Gird up the loins of your mind to gather in the wanderings of your mind." And that's not always as easy a thing to do as it might sound. Our minds have a tendency to go off in every direction. Most everybody that came out here this morning came out here with your mind on something. And very likely you came out here with your mind on something besides being at church. And trying to dismiss that from your mind and begin to think about the Lord and His service is a very difficult thing. Sometimes I come out to church and I've got something on my mind, something has seized my mind, and I try to listen and cannot listen to save my life. I discipline myself. Now, put that out of your mind. You're in church now. Think about church thoughts. And I bring in the wanderings of my mind. And for about 60 seconds, I think about church things. And 60 seconds later, I'm off to the races again. And sometimes I go through the entire meeting that way. I can tell by the expression on some of your faces that some of you have had that experience. But what a benefit singing is to help to draw in our minds and to get our minds on better things. "For the law, having a shadow of good things to come, and not the very image of the things, can never with those sacrifices which they offered year by year continually make the comers thereunto perfect." Our Primitive Baptist preachers enjoy preaching about the inadequacy of the law. How that the law is not sufficient to take away sin. And it was not, I'm talking about the law of Moses now, it was not sufficient to take away sins, and it had built into the very observance of the law a reminder that it was not sufficient to take away sins. He says in the next verse, "For then would they not have ceased to be offered, because that the worshipers once purged should have had no more conscience of sin." He's saying if these sacrifices would do the work of taking away sins, then they would have ceased to be offered. I never read that text, but that I remember a time years ago when I was supposed to send off my quarterly estimate to the IRS, and I couldn't find the form. The accountant had made one out for me, but I couldn't find it. So I had to go back and get him to make another one. And then after I sent that one off, I decided to have one more try at it. And I went back and found it. As you can imagine, the very last place I looked. A day or so later on the job, some smart mouth said, "Harold, did you ever wonder why it always seems to be in the very last place you look?" I always bite. He said, "Dummy, that's because when you find it, you quit looking." But you see, if these sacrifices had gotten the job done, they would have quit offering them. The fact that they kept offering those sacrifices over and over and over and over again signified the job was not accomplished. You may notice that sometimes we preachers repeat ourselves. I repeat myself every now and then. And if I repeat myself, that's a pretty good indication I lost my place. Either I don't know where I was headed, sometimes don't know where I've been, may not even know where I am as far as the message is concerned, so I repeat myself trying to gather my wits about me to figure out where am I headed from here. God repeats himself, but God never has lost his place. If God repeats himself, he repeats himself for emphasis. Do you remember in Psalms 89, where David was talking about the security of the heaven-born soul? And four times in rapid succession, he talks about how that we are eternally secure in Christ Jesus. In Romans chapter 5, Paul was talking about how that we lost everything in Christ, lost everything in Adam, and we gained everything in Christ. He says it five different times in five successive verses. That's for the purpose of impressing it upon our minds. But in the lost service, they offered the same sacrifices, as it says here, year by year continually. They had one sacrifice called the daily burnt offering. They offered that sacrifice today, tomorrow, the next day, year after year after year. For 1,500 years, they kept repeating it over and over again. Now, if after that many repetitions, somebody doesn't get the message, they're just not listening. You see, the law was not intended to take away sins. It was intended for the purpose, among other things, of reminding us that we are sinners. He says, but in those sacrifices, there is a remembrance again made of sins every year. If our observance could satisfy the justice of God, then the law would certainly have done that. They had all kinds of sacrifices and feasts and rituals. They had one kind of a sacrifice that required a male sheep, another a female, another it could be either one. One sacrifice required a goat, another two goats, one required a bullock, one required a turtle dove or a young pigeon, one required a young heifer. There was one that was baked in an oven, one that was baked in a pan, one that had oil spread on the top of it, one had oil mixed in with it. In one, they had put blood on the person's ear and on his thumb of his right hand and the great toe of his right foot. Sometimes they had put blood on the four horns of the altar. Sometimes it was poured out on the ground. Part of the sacrifice was burned on the altar. Part of it went to the priest as part of his livelihood. Part of it was carried outside the camp and burned. You can go on and on and on with all of the rituals that God required of them, but it still was not possible to take away sins. You see, it wouldn't change the fact that we are by nature sinners. We came into this world sinners. And it didn't take long for us to demonstrate that we were sinners. An acquaintance of mine, he's barely an acquaintance, tells about a time when his sister had delivered a new baby. And he went to the hospital to see the new baby. And he did like we all do. He went back there to the big plate glass windows and did all the oohs and the ahs and made silly faces and went back to his sister's room. And he says, "Sis, I believe that's the prettiest little sinner I ever saw in my life." Offended his sister. She just got all put out with him. How dare he come back here and tell me my little baby, that precious little thing, is a sinner? About 3 days later, her time was up, and they sent her home. And they sent the baby with her. And about 6 weeks later, she called her brother. She said, "You're right. That baby is a sinner." She was at her wit's end, you see. Did you ever wonder how it is that little babies learn how to hit? And if another little fella is close by and this little fella doesn't like what the other one's doing, maybe picked up a toy that he ought not to have touched. That baby comes into this world knowing that if he claps that other kid up the side of the head with something, that it's going to make him unhappy. And it's his intention, if he can, to make that other kid unhappy. So he claps him up the head with the side of the head with something. We came into this world selfish. But babies are they're selfish. They're selfish of the mother's time. They want attention, and they want it now, and they don't matter. They don't care about anything else. They want attention. They want it now, and they're going to let everybody in earshot know that I want some attention, and I want it now. I remember reading about a little girl that had gone to school, first day of school, show and tell day, and they were, you know, allowed to tell about what went on at their house during the summer. And she said, "We've got a new baby at our house, but it's turning into a boy." But you see, babies don't turn into boys. Kittens don't turn into cats. Pups don't turn into dogs. And babies don't turn into sinners. We were born sinners. And nothing you and I do can change that nature, do you see? It doesn't change our nature. If we were to quit sinning, somebody says you can't quit sinning. Of course not. But suppose you could. Suppose that you quit sinning. And you don't sin anymore. Nothing. From this point on, everything you do is absolutely right. Would that satisfy God? It might not make your situation any worse, but it wouldn't make it any better. I remember once several years ago on the job, there was an old fellow that came in, did the janitorial work there at the office, good friend of mine, one of the finest people you ever met. And he asked me, he said, "Harold, do you folks do any good getting sinners to come out to church?" And I said, well, we hardly ever have very many. But I said, we always have a few. I said, I've never been out to one of our churches. We didn't have a few sinners there. There's maybe just a handful, but there's always a few sinners. He said, I don't know how you do it. He says, we just can't get sinners to come to church. Well, you see, the problem was we had a different definition. And I said, let me ask you. Suppose a murderer quits killing people. How long will he have to go without killing anybody before he quits being a murderer? He says, why, you know, if he ever killed anybody, he'll be a murderer to the day he dies. Suppose a bank robber quits robbing banks. How long will he have to go without robbing a bank before he quits being a bank robber? He gave me the same answer. I said, that's right. And if you've ever sinned, you'll be a sinner till the day you die. Do you see, reforming from this point on, if you could do it, would not change the past. Suppose you ran up a big bill at some at a grocery store back during the days when you could do that. And you get in debt farther than you can pay. And you see the merchant one day and you tell him, I tell you, I've been terribly concerned about that bill and I finally figured out what I'm going to have to do. He says, I'm just going to have to quit charging anything at your store. I'm not going to charge another thing there as long as I live. The merchant says, well, I think that might be a good idea. I was kind of planning to suggest that myself. But what about this bill you already owe? Oh, that's all right. You see, you don't understand. I'm not going to charge anything there as long as I live. Well, that's a good idea. But what about the bill you already owe? You see, if you and I were to quit sinning, that wouldn't erase the sin debt we already owe. The law was never given for the purpose of putting away sins. I've spent much more time on this introduction than I meant to. I meant just to clear the ground for about 5 minutes. I've spent about 20 minutes. But I'd like for us to talk, for a little while this morning about the benefits that Israel did receive from the law. The law was never given for the purpose of saving people for eternal heaven. But the law of Moses was given to Israel for their benefit. The law of Moses was the best system of law, bar none, that has ever that any people have ever had. It was the very best economic system that any nation ever had. No nation ever before, ever since, or ever will have an economic system to compare with the law of Moses. The law of Moses was never intended to save anybody for heaven. It was given as a system of government for a particular people at a particular time. It was given as a system of worship for a particular people at a particular time. If Israel had done what God required them to do, and they agreed over and over they would do it, they would have been the healthiest, the wealthiest, the happiest people on the face of the earth. There were health benefits to the law of Moses. I don't know how much those people knew about high blood pressure, for instance. I doubt they had a blood pressure cuff. I never have read anything about their having blood pressure cuffs. I have a little bit of a problem with high blood pressure myself, and I take two different kinds of pills for it. I take a whole fistful of pills for one ailment or another. But I've discovered that none of those pills do anywhere near as much for my blood pressure as it does leaving off the sausage and bacon and pork chops. Now, I didn't like coming to that decision. I just fought tooth and nail against that. But when finally I really realized that I'd probably do better if I'd leave off the pork. Blood pressure's not the problem. I still take the pills. I'm going to talk to the doctor about that. But you see, I don't know how much they knew about blood pressure. God just told them to start with, just leave off the pork. There was one requirement the law of Moses made. It said that if you touch a dead body, that you're unclean for the rest of that day. I doubt they understood exactly why God said that. But I recall reading about a doctor in Austria many years ago, 120, 30, 40 years ago, who had noticed that one of the most dangerous places for a sick person to be was in the hospital. And he noticed that doctors would examine the corpse of somebody who had just died, and he'd go right straight from that corpse to examine a living patient. And before long, the living patient had the same thing that the other person just died with. Well, this doctor, Ignaz Semmelweis, was a Bible student, and he noticed where God said, if you touch a dead body, you're unclean for the rest of the day. Well, it didn't make sense. It wasn't practical anyway for the doctor not to do anything the rest of the day after he examined a dead body. So he suggested you need to at least scrub your hands from you go from one patient to another. Well, that he got the attention of the folks there at the hospital. They ran him off. Well, after a while, he finally found a hospital where they'd go along with that, and the death rate dropped, do you see? There was a reason for that requirement when God said, if you touch a dead body, you're unclean for the rest of the day. Read about an outbreak of botulism. Several people in a little cluster died with botulism. The CDC got involved in it. They began to track it down. And they discovered that every one of those people who had died with botulism had eaten at the same restaurant. So they went there and began to check things out. And they discovered that one of their suppliers had been sending some contaminated food to that restaurant. And they quit buying from that supplier. They scrubbed all their utensils, steamed them, just boiled them and so on. And that was the end of the botulism. For a little while. And after a while, there was another outbreak of botulism. The CDC gets involved again. They go through all the motions. They come right back to the restaurant. They're buying their supplies from a different supplier. But their customers are still getting sick. But the CDC people discovered that this restaurant had crockery inserts in their steam table. Do you remember in the law of Moses? The law of Moses says that if a rat falls in a metal container, you can scrub it and still use it. But if it falls into an earthenware container, the only thing to do is to throw it away, to break it, to get rid of it. Because you see, those botulism spores got down inside there, and even though they steamed it, they boiled it and all that, after a while they worked their way to the outside and started making people sick again. I doubt the people in Israel understood why God told them to break the earthenware container, but God knew what he was doing. There are some diseases that Jewish men just almost never have. There's a reason for that, which I don't have time to get into. There's some kinds of cancer that Jewish women do not get unless there's a Jewish man that's involved in the situation. All kinds of medical benefits accrued to Israel because of the requirements that God gave them under the law of Moses. If they had observed what God told them to do, they would have been the healthiest, the wealthiest, the happiest people on the face of the earth. Now, there's a broad range of things we could talk about for a long time, but I want to touch just a few high points before my time runs out. One of the benefits that God gave to Israel was the law of the Sabbath, the seventh day. Now, that was Saturday, by the way, and it was a sign to Israel. You see, Sunday is not the Sabbath. The New Testament refers to Sunday as the Lord's Day. The Sabbath, the seventh day, God gave as a sign to Israel. In other words, that seventh day observance was given to Israel in a way that it was never given to anybody else. And by the way, it's the only one of the ten that is not reconfirmed in the New Testament. But the Lord said that the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. And all the benefit that would have accrued to that nation if they had taken advantage of that one aspect of the law of Moses. For one thing, it gave everybody a day of rest, one day out of seven. And it is a proven fact that everybody physically needs one day in seven to rest. Our bodies need one day of rest. And to approach the subject from another direction, it's a proven fact that you can turn out more work in a regular six-day week than you can in a regular seven-day week. Somebody says, Harold Hunt, that doesn't make good arithmetic to say you can turn out more work in 6 days than you can in seven. That's not what I said. That's not what I said. Underscore that word regular. You see, sometimes a person gets so carried away with his job, with his career, with whatever he's engaged in, that he thinks he can work at that job every waking hour, 7 days a week, and he is sure that he can turn out 1/6 more in a week by working that seventh day that he can in six. And that'll work for a week, 2 weeks, 6 or 8 weeks perhaps. But after a while, it catches up with you. And after a while, you are so exhausted all the time that you're never working at full potential any of the time. And you wind up so exhausted in body and mind, you mess up so much, you make so many mistakes, you have to go back and do things over so much of the time, you wind up just dragging your tracks out, that you're not turning out near as much work as you would have if you had taken advantage of that one day in seven to rest. You see, another thing about that is that this idea of one day in seven to rest introduces the principle of hope into the work week. Now, a lot of folks belittle Primitive Baptists because we have so much to say about hope. And sometimes somebody makes the comment, if I didn't have anything better than hope, I'd look for something better. You know, I believe we could take just a few minutes and demonstrate that our entire economic system runs on hope. For that matter, it was hope that got every little schoolboy, every little schoolgirl through school. We would never have made it. We would never have survived if it had not been for that precious hope that Friday's going to come someday. All week long we count down. We're almost like people in the military. We're counting down. Friday's going to come someday. Then we go home and rest for a few, couple of days, and usually forget the homework that we were supposed to have had by Monday, but that's another story. You see, this one day of rest introduces the principle of hope into the work week. Hope is the foundation of our entire economy. Let me ask you, what person would mortgage everything he has to finance a new business if it was not for the hope that he can turn that business into a profitable enterprise? What farmer would prepare the ground and sow the seed if it was not for the hope of a harvest. What young bride would dare walk down the aisle and say, I do, if it was not for that sweet hope that she and her husband are going to have a happy life together? You take hope out, and what do you have left? We're like those people Paul talked about in Ephesians chapter 2, isn't it? Without hope and without God in the world. Somebody says, if I didn't have anything better than hope, I guess if a person is in that frame of mind, you'd have to call him hopeless, wouldn't you? And nobody wants to be called hopeless. But anyway, without anybody asking, God provided one day in seven that he expected them, except in cases of necessity. If the ox is in the ditch and so on, you need to get him out. But God provided that seventh day as a much needed day of rest. But that's only one part of the Sabbatic law. There were three major parts to the Sabbatic law. And again, we said before that the law of the Sabbath was given as a sign between God and Israel. And there's no way that you could, even if you tried, apply the entire law of the Sabbath to anybody except Israel in the land of Canaan. God provided that they should work 6 years. And the seventh year, they should take a year off. That's where that word sabbatical came from. That everybody would take a seventh year sabbatical. You don't put out any crop. You don't harvest anything that grows of itself. Well, that raises a question. What are you going to eat during that seventh year? God said, I'll cause the land to bring forth twice as much the sixth year. If a field has been yielding 50 bushels, the sixth year I'll cause it to yield 100 bushels. How can he do that? He's God. He can do anything he wants to. So he said, take a year off. Relax. You don't have to work the way you have these other 6 years. Back during the heyday of the labor unions, John L. Lewis, Walter Reuther, Eugene V. Debs, none of those labor leaders would ever have dared to try to put that on the negotiating table. Can you imagine Walter Reuther going up before the automobile industry in Michigan and saying, listen, we're going to come out on strike if you don't let us have a year's vacation every 7 years. God gave that to Israel. Take a year off. What about my debts? I've been making payments on these debts, and he expects to have a payment every month. God says, that's all right. He says, at the end of that sixth year, he says, this is the year of the Lord's release. If you've got any debts, they're wiped out. You don't owe any more debts. If you've been sold into bondage, you're set free. If a person is sold into slavery, the seventh year, everybody's free. Somebody says, now, Brother Hunt, you talked about how that was the best economic system anybody ever had. And now you talk about somebody being sold into bondage? Well, we still have slavery here in America today, and I suppose in some sense we have more slavery in America today than we ever have. Somebody said, wait a minute, Harold. Not. I remember reading about Abraham Lincoln in September of 1862 and the Emancipation Proclamation and how that he set all the slaves free. Well, he did that, and then the money people figured out another way to get us in slavery. Do you ever get these little letters in the mail, these unsolicited credit cards? Probably do, don't you? Every little bit, you have been pre-approved for more credit than you'd ever have any need for. All you have to do is just start using the card and everything's all right. And they give you that really easy credit. And all you have to pay is 2% of the balance each month. You can have $2,000 worth of credit. And all you have to pay is $40. That's 2% of the balance each month. And they keep drawing you and drawing you and drawing you in until you get to where that you cannot conceivably pay any more than 2% of the balance. They get you in, say, $20,000 in debt. $20,000 to a credit card? Sure. According to the newspapers, the average American family owes close to $10,000. That's $200 a month on credit cards. They get you far enough in debt that you cannot pay any more than the minimum. By now, you're maxed out. You can't charge any more because you're maxed out. You can't get out of debt to them because you cannot pay any more than the minimum. And by then, they have your interest rate up to 23.99% per year, which is awfully close to 2% per month. And you see, if they've got you to where your payment is $600 a month, you can't pay any more, so you can't get out. You can't charge any more because you're maxed out. They own you. They own you up to the first $600 or $400 or $300 you make each month. You see, slavery is a system where one person does the work and somebody else gets the pay. At least the credit card company lets you handle it. They let you pick up the check, deposit it, and write a check to them. The IRS doesn't even do that. Alan Keyes refers to the graduated income tax as a slave tax. Again, slavery is where one person does the work and somebody else gets the money. The credit card company at least lets you get the money and look at it before you write them a check. They still own you up to a particular figure. The IRS won't even let you get it. They take it out of your check before you ever see it. Again, up to the figure that they own you. Whatever rate you have reached there, whether it's 28% or something below that, they own you up to that particular figure. You can go on through the rest of the economy. Slavery has not been eradicated near as much as a lot of folks would like to think it has been. But in the old economy under the law service, every seventh year, all debts were erased. If a person was in bondage, he was set free, and we start all over again. And if a person was in bondage and he goes free, the law says, don't send him away broke. Give him some livestock out of your flock and give him some supplies to get started with. I've never known any other nation to have any arrangement like that, have you? But there's one more. The law of Moses also provided, and this is the third part of the Sabbatic law. That law provided that every time seven Sabbatic years passed by, seven times seven, that's 49. Just to keep it on even numbers, God says, by the way, just go ahead and take the 50th year off too. I'll do it just like I did that sixth year. And the 48th year, I'll cause the land to bring forth three times as much. And you won't have to work for 2 years. And if you owe any debts, set free. If you're in bondage, you're set free. And by the way, he said, the land shall not be sold forever, for the land is mine. Do you remember when they came into the land of promise, God divided the entire land by lot. Judah got one portion, and Simeon got another, and Naphtali got another, and Zebulun got another, and so on down the line. Every tribe got their particular little province, and every family got enough land to support themselves on. And then on the 10th day of the 7th month of the 50th year, on the Day of Atonement, he commanded that they should proclaim liberty throughout all the land to the inhabitants thereof. You recognize that, don't you? That's the inscription around the Liberty Bell at Independence Hall in Philadelphia. That's where they got that inscription, by the way. On the 10th day of the 7th month of the 50th year, you sound the jubilee. Proclaim liberty throughout all the land. Can you imagine there's somebody out there, maybe he doesn't know the law. Not everybody did. And he hears this ram's horn being sounded. And he notices that the roads are full of people going somewhere. But he's down there working for his master, and he's just slaving away in the sun. And his curiosity gets the best of him, and he goes up there and asks, where's everybody going? Don't you know this is the Day of Atonement? This is the year of Jubilee. Well, that's all right. I can't go anywhere. I've got this work to do. You don't understand. This is the year of Jubilee. You're not in slavery anymore. Doesn't make any difference. I don't have a dime to my name. I've got to work for this man or I can't eat. That's all right. He's got to supply you out of the threshing floor. He's got to supply you out of his flock. But I still don't have anywhere to live. But you don't understand. When God divided the land to Israel by lot, he said, the land shall not be sold forever, for the land is mine. He says, the 50th year, you have total land reform. And all the land goes back to the original owners or to the heirs of the original owners. And you see, if you had sold a parcel of property, or if your daddy or your granddaddy, now I know you're supposed to say your father or your grandfather, but up in the mountains we say daddy and granddaddy. We're not all that keen on father and grandfather, but anyway, maybe your daddy or your granddaddy sold it. You get it back. It's just waiting down there. Well, what do I have to do to get it? Just go down there and move in. Just take possession. Sounds a lot like primitive Baptist doctrine to me, doesn't it? You? What did I do to get it? Not a thing. You get it because of who your daddy is, do you see? Can you imagine what a stir that would make through the land when everybody was in debt is all of a sudden out of debt? Everybody that's in bondage is out of bondage, and he finds that he's got a home waiting on him down there, and all he has to do is to pack up and go down there and move in. Do you see, one of the great problems in the economies of the world is that in ever so many places, a few very wealthy families own all the land. That's the reason that the economies in Central America and South America are in such a shambles, because a few people own all the land and most everybody else are tenants on that land. God says completely redistribute the land every 50 years. Everybody starts over again. Everybody starts even. Somebody said, well, now, wait a minute. Doesn't that discourage thrift? Somebody works hard and wants to get ahead, and that doesn't provide him any incentive. God took care of that too. He said, any land inside the city, if you sell a place inside the city and you don't redeem it within a year, then it does not go out in the Jubilee. So if somebody could build a 10-unit apartment house on land he bought inside the city, he got to keep it if the man didn't redeem the land within a year. If he could build 110-unit apartment houses or 10 100-unit apartment houses, he gets to keep that and pass it on to the children. You see, It provided a system where the industrious could get ahead. It provided a system where the poor could not be forever oppressed. All they had to do was to just move in. But notice one other thing about it. It provided, not only would there be total land reform every 50 years, it meant that if any of your kinfolks had moved away, then it would have the effect of sorting out all the people and moving the kinfolks back, where that every 50th year, most everybody in the community would be kinfolks to everybody else in the community. Think of the social impact of that. You see, they didn't have Social Security. They didn't need it. Do you see, if you've got all your kids living all around you, and they had big families back then, if you've got all your little ones around you, you've got them to take care of you, and be assured if they're taking care of you, they're going to expect mom and dad to do a little bit of work as best they can. They don't expect them to sit down, you know, on the rocking chair. Wouldn't really need nursing homes, would you? You see, if you've got a big family and everybody in the neighborhood's either your brother, your sister, your niece, your nephew, your cousin, maybe your third cousin, but everybody in the neighborhood is kin to you, then there are folks there to look after you and see after you. No house payment. You see, God gave them the land. They didn't have to buy it. It was given to them. You wouldn't need an automobile. All your kinfolks were living right close to you. And every community would be self-sufficient. You don't need health insurance because you got all your family there around you to look after you. There's never been a better system than God provided for Israel. Now, the law of Moses is not the law for America. It's not the law for any other nation on earth. But there are principles involved in that law that are benefit to any people in this day. When our founding fathers established this nation, they drew the principles on which this country is founded from English common law, from Roman law, and from the law of Moses. Those were the three sources. So the law of Moses is not the law of the land, but it was one of the sources that our founding fathers drew from to set up this country. A few weeks ago, there was one of these overeducated types on one of these news talk shows, and she was disparaging the Christian religion and disparaging the statement that I just made about the foundation of our law. And she said, that's not right. She said, our law was founded on English common law and Roman law and the Code of Hammurabi. Do you remember reading about the Code of Hammurabi in school? Hammurabi was an old Babylonian king who is probably the same one that Genesis refers to as Amraphel. You remember when the four kings came and fought against the five kings there in Genesis chapter 14. But anyway, she said our law was based on Roman law, English law, and the Code of Hammurabi. Problem is, as great a law, no doubt, as the Code of Hammurabi was, nobody anywhere knew anything about the Code of Hammurabi until about 100 years ago. Our nation was over 100 years old before anybody knew that that law had ever been. I tell you, if I didn't know any more about what I was talking about than that, I don't think I would go on national television and let the whole country know about it. She reminds me of a comment by my favorite philosopher, Jerry Clowers. Jerry Clowers likes to refer to those people who are educated beyond their intelligence. The law of Moses was never given for the purpose of saving anybody for eternal heaven. Never intended for that. But the law of Moses was the best system of law for the government of a nation that any nation has ever had. It was the best economic system that any nation had ever had. It was the best health system that any nation had ever had. God said, if you do these things, I will put none of these diseases, the diseases of Egypt he was talking about, upon you. There are some folks who have the idea that all illness is psychosomatic. That's not right. That's not right. But it is a fact that a lot of disease is psychosomatic. A lot of times a person is sick because he makes himself sick. Back about 30 years ago, there was a man by the name of Macmillan, S.I. Macmillan, who wrote a book entitled None of These Diseases, and he used that text as the title of his book, where the Lord promised Israel, I'll put none of these diseases upon you. And he was showing how that ever so many ailments are really psychosomatic. And one illustration was, he was talking about colitis. Now, I don't know a whole lot about colitis, but anyway, I'm told that it can be brought on by stress. And I suppose that's right. I've been told that anyway. But anyway, he was telling about some woman that was sick. She had a bad case of colitis. And her husband told the kids, says, leave mama alone. She's sick. She's got colitis again. And the little boy wanted to know, who has mama been colliding with now? But you see, a lot of our ailments we do bring on ourselves. Paul said in Philippians chapter 4, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of good report, if there be any virtue and if there be any praise, think on these things. And he said, the peace of God, which passeth all understanding, shall keep your hearts and minds in perfect peace. I've always applied that as to be talking about peace of mind and peace at heart. And that text does apply in that way. But this writer, and if you care to read his book, it would be interesting, I'm sure, to you. It shows how that not only does that apply in the sense of giving peace of mind, that also it has to do with preserving our hearts to some extent from heart trouble, our minds from the ailments. Now, there are a lot of ailments of our minds that there's not a thing we can do about it. Those are physical and so on. Some of them have to do with imbalance in our bodies. But it's also a fact, and psychiatrists will tell you this, and they tell it right sometimes in spite of themselves, that sometimes people go crazy because they can't stand themselves. And they go crazy and get out into a world of their own trying to get away from themselves. And I have met a few people in my time that I believe that if I had that personality, I'd want to go crazy too to get away from that particular personality. The law of Moses. Never intended to get anybody home to eternal heaven. But they were blessed as no nation had ever been. A couple of other points before we close. We've got about 4 more minutes. I always quit at 12. That's dinner time. But anyway, and I think I've lost my point sometimes. That happens to me. And since I've lost my point, rather than stand here and repeat myself, we're going to quit for dinner 4 minutes early. Let us stand. Let us stand and sing. If there's one who desires a home in the church, and anyway, we old Baptists receive members, you come forward just now, and the church will hear you.